Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Coming up on Word of Mouth, an ego boost for the middle-aged. An argument for midlife as a time of essential human development rather than sports cars and crises. And the psyches of superheroes. A California shrink takes on the identities and neuroses driving our favorite comic book characters and those who love them.
Many people wonder whether he has a narcissistic personality disorder, but I think people who have that disorder are unrealistically full of themselves. He is Iron Man, after all.
And we'll hear from another scientist researching a mind-controlling fungus that transforms marching ants into zombie slaves. All that and an anthropological look at the world's most commonly used sporting good, the ball.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of a pyramid thrown my way.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of mouth tosses up new ideas after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
The word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, the decidedly human history of the object of many a sport lover's affection, the ball. And doomsday preppers stock up on hopes for finding love. A dating site caters to those who aren't so busy preparing for the apocalypse that they've stopped looking for the one. But first, the middle age advantage. All that 40 is the new 30 boosterism aside, midlife is not the beginning of the downward spiral. David Bainbridge is a clinical veterinary anatomist at Cambridge University and the author of several books, including Middle Age, A Natural History. He writes about recent findings that middle age is a pivotal part of the human evolutionary process and potentially the most productive years of our lives. I spoke to him from his home in the UK on what was the perfect day for me to embrace life's lumpy middle. Well, I have to tell you, today is actually my birthday, and I am at the age that I used to consider very, very old. So you writing about middle age as an exceptional characteristic of an exceptional species, I really want to believe it, but it sounds a little rosy.
Well, I mean, I'm really approaching middle age as a zoologist. I mean, I originally trained as a veterinary surgeon, and I had a degree in zoology. And so, first of all, I used to write about animals, and then I started writing about humans, and I started about humans comparing them with other animals. And I just realized there's this new phase, which the human species seems to have evolved in the middle of their life plan, which other animals just don't seem to have. And the more you look at it, the more it's almost like nature's given us a gift of, 20 healthy years that really other animals just don't have.
So middle age, as you're putting it, doesn't really resemble the hallmarks of passive decline. So does that mean the bodies or mind are deteriorating in what, a more orderly fashion?
Well, not many things actually do deteriorate. There's a few things that deteriorate. In a way, they're almost the exceptions that prove my rule, if you like. Things like eyesight and skin elasticity are obviously allowed to go a bit over middle age. I mean, one of the things I noticed very suddenly is going long-sighted, which is it's one of these things. It's quite unusual until you're 35, and it's universal at 50. And again, you can see these very specific timed changes. You look at other body systems, and really not much is going wrong at all. Your brain is pretty good. It's actually peaking in many ways in middle age, in some cases right into the 50s. And, the body, not really very much goes wrong. You're very, very unlikely to die between 40 and 60 compared to most of the other decades of your life.
Well, what are some of the reasons that these middle-aged people in hunter-gatherer societies, people in their 40s and 50s, might have been valuable to the society, as you point out?
Well, the interesting thing that happens in humans, that happens very rarely in other animals, is we stop breeding. Women usually don't conceive many children after the age, obviously it varies, but around the age of 42, 43. And, of course, if their other half stays with them, if their partner stays with them, that effectively means that they become infertile around that age as well. And yet they don't get ill. And you look at, for example, resource acquisition by human hunter-gatherers, and you actually find it peaks around the age of 45. So, of course, these are people who, they're already a little bit slower, maybe a little bit weaker than people in their 20s, but they're actually more productive. And it just shows that becoming human, it takes a long time. It takes decades and decades to get good at it. And that's one of the things we need all this time for, is providing resources for the rest of the tribe, and especially providing resources for all those young humans taking that ridiculously long time, 20 years, to grow up and develop.
Well, you also point out that they have a role, middle-aged people, as kind of cultural conveyors. The wise men, the crones. So have we just created a kind of role for middle age?
No, because, I mean, you do see it in the world today. You see, you know, everywhere you see middle-aged people training younger people, telling younger people what to do. And really, you know, all the important aspects of human life, whether it's, you know, on the sports field, in the office, or in my house, for example. And yet you look back, and I think that is what they're for. The thing you've got to realize about humans is we've taken a very high-energy, high-information approach to life. And in a way, it's quite risky. In many animals, they basically they inherit all the behavior they need in their genes. So some animals just come out of an egg and just walk off, and they just know instinctively how to do everything. And then other animals, they need to learn a few things as they go along, sometimes from their parents. And humans are completely at the extreme end of the spectrum, which is that if a baby is born and grows up in the absence of other people, it doesn't acquire any of the important social or technological or linguistic information that it takes to function as a human. It's really culture. I mean, it's culture is very important. Passage from culture from one generation to the next is absolutely essential. And you need healthy older people to be around to convey that information.
But how about some of the risky behavior we associate with midlife crises? For example, you know, sort of leaving your long-term relationship, buying a sports car, you know, those kind of things that at least in contemporary human beings may be a cliche, but there's a reason for forming that pattern.
Yes, I mean, I think the reason for it is that it's a great story. The midlife crisis is a funny story. But I think most psychologists agreed it doesn't really exist in any clear-cut sense. You're no more likely to experience life transitions in your 40s than in your 30s or your 50s. You're actually less likely to split up with your partner in middle age than you are in your 20s or your 30s. As for going off and doing irresponsible things, I think that's something that people want to do throughout their life. I think they just get to middle age and sometimes their children are at an age where they can do it or they have a little bit more money or a little bit more time and they just feel, well, no, now's the time to do it. I don't think it's a crisis. I think it's a positive thing, and I think it's just because we realize, you know, there's more to life than just looking after your children and just providing for other people.
Well, David, I'm going to take that as a special message to me today. I appreciate your time. David Bainbridge, a lecturer at Cambridge University, author of Middle Age and Natural History, and other books on teenagers, the science of pregnancy, and other topics. You can find out more at wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, how's middle age working out for you? Are you in it, past it? Do you dread it or look forward to middle age? You can leave your comment at wordofmouthradio.org or on Facebook or send us a tweet. And from prepping for the third quarter of our lives to prepping for doomsday.
Quite honestly, I do not think that my kids understand the apocalypse coming. We do teach them skills. You know, our son, he knows how to cook. He can make his own cereal. And he is very protective of our daughter.
The new TLC reality show, Livin' for the Apocalypse, follows so-called preppers, people getting off the grid, hoarding food, and otherwise making ready for the end of days. There's one key component that preppers cannot buy in a survival kit: love, companionship, someone to help propagate the species. The online dating site Survivalist Singles brings preppers together under the tagline, "Why face the future alone?" Blake Ellis is a personal finance writer for CNNMoney.com who wrote about the doomsday dating site. Word of Mouth intern Danielle Lima caught up with Blake last week and asked her to describe the typical user profile on SurvivalistSingles.com.
People are signing up from all over the world, but there is one common interest, and that's preparing for some sort of future disaster or a doomsday scenario. Some people are very religious and believe that a biblical apocalypse is coming. Others are spiritual and kind of sense that there are some huge life-changing events on the horizon. I would say the majority just kind of want to be prepared for anything and everything. So whether it's an economic collapse, a tsunami, or even something like a job loss, a common phrase that people use on the site and by preppers in general is the end of the world as we know it.
Now, statistics from more conventional websites like Match.com, the guy-to-girl ratio is about even. Survivalist Singles, on the other hand, I couldn't help but notice a bit of a majority.
Yes, there are definitely more men signing up. Right now, there are about 4 men for every woman. So on the one hand, it's a great place for a woman to find a survivalist man, but on the other hand, some women seem to be getting some unwanted attention. One woman on the site said that she hopes that the ratio will eventually even out because right now she's just being bombarded with messages.
The Survivalist Singles page has a slogan, "Don't face the future alone." What sort of qualities are people looking for?
Well, there are all kinds of skills that people can bring to the table. There's hunting, there's camping, there's shooting firearms, canning meat, storing food. One woman said that the best skill that she could bring to the table would be to make humanure, which is essentially turning human waste into compost in case the electricity goes down. So yeah, there are all sorts of qualities that would be beneficial to a survival group.
In your article, you mention a few people who have already found love on the website. Others have had a little more trouble. Can you tell us about a few of those?
Yeah, so a lot of the people I talked to said that the biggest problem was distance. Because the site is so small with about 3,000 members now, everyone is really spread out across the country. So if someone connects with another person on the site, the chances of them being nearby are really slim. So they have to kind of have phone calls and decide if they really want to make the effort to go meet that person. That can be really hard. So they're hoping that as more people join, that that'll become easier. But other people have found love on the site. And I talked to one man who said that, I think it was his first day on the site, he found who he now calls his twin flame, which he describes as being a level up from a soulmate, and he's been talking with her for a little over a month now, and he's already going to move to Missouri to be with her. So it definitely does work out for some people on the site.
Obviously, there's a lot of hype amongst users of a possible apocalypse at the end of 2012. So what are the hopes of these couples by getting together? Are they looking for someone to hide away with in a bunker, or are they looking for someone to simply elope with in what could be their final days?
Yeah, there is a lot of 2012 talk, but in general, most of these people are looking for someone to survive a disaster with, and that's why they're called survivalists. So they're hoping that by finding someone on the site, they'll have another person to prepare with and survive whatever comes their way, and then hopefully rebuild a life together after that disaster passes.
Blake Ellis is a personal finance writer for CNNMoney.com. She was speaking with Word of Mouth intern Danielle Lima. Danielle has just finished her internship with Word of Mouth. So great to have you with us, Danielle. Thank you, and good luck. Let's just hope this whole apocalypse thing doesn't happen before you graduate and find a good job. Coming up, we'll kick around the history of the world's most popular sporting good, the ball. Word of Mouth returns to the field in just a moment.
Man, who's that cat coming down the street?
I don't know, but it sounds to me like that different man with the bone.
Sure having himself a ball.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Simple, universal, playable. The ball is among the most recognizable artifacts of human culture. It's also the driver of an estimated $500 billion a year sports industry. Harvard anthropologist John Fox set off on a global adventure to dig into the ancient past and uncover the origins and evolution of our favorite ball games. His new book is called The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks a lot, Virginia. Great to be here.
Well, this all started with tossing a ball around for you, so appropriately enough. Tell us the story of what set you on this quest.
Yes, you know, it started as an innocent game of backyard catch with my 7-year-old son. And in the middle of playing, he stopped and he had this funny look in his face and he said, "Hey, Dad, why do we play ball anyway?" And it was one of those existential questions, you know, only a 7-year-old can really ask. And when I thought about it, I didn't have an easy answer. I couldn't tell them where all these games came from, and I couldn't tell them why it mattered so much to us. So off I went on a journey.
Right. So you began your research into the ball, not with humans, however, but animals, dolphins and bonobos. Why?
I think anybody who's ever played catch with their dog knows that humans didn't invent the idea of play. Clearly, this idea of play was something much deeper, much more fundamental than humans. So, yeah, I decided to go deep into kind of the origins of play in the animal kingdom and in the brain itself.
What makes play so important to the development of humans and the human brain?
Well, a few things. First of all, play is a way that we engage the world as young children. One of the fundamental stages of childhood development is the ability to roll a ball back and forth with another kid. So it's a physical capability. It's also your cognitive development. It's also a social thing. I mean, we play with other people. It's a form of collaboration, cooperation. It's a way we get to know how to relate to other people. So it has so many dimensions, and it's important on so many levels.
And a big part of your exploration is about the physical object itself. You know, why the ball and not the cube or the pyramid, which could also be tossed around?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of a pyramid thrown my way. The ball is a fascinating object. First of all, it's, you know, we live on a ball, we live on a sphere. It's kind of an elemental form. But it's also, you know, I think of it as a kinetically interesting object. And by that, I mean, you know, there's no other object that can spin and ricochet and bounce. You know, think of a knuckleball pitcher and what he can do to a ball. There's really no other physical object like that in nature. So it's no wonder that it fascinated us for so long.
But you found a lot of odd objects that have been used as balls or what they've been made of through the ages. Can you give us a sample?
Well, you know, funny enough, the first mention of the game of tennis is from a 13th century document that talks about a monk who lost a bargain with the devil, basically. And he goes to hell and he gets knocked back and forth by demons. Becomes the ball himself. But I don't think that was the typical form of play.
It's a very grim picture of the fiery furnaces of hell. But there's more on the origins of tennis in the book. It actually did become what you call the game of priests before it became the game of kings.
Yeah, so tennis originated in France in around the 13th century. And it was played in the monasteries, in the cloisters, by monks who were probably bored between prayers and penance. It was played with the hand. There was no net. It was called jeu de paume, the game of the hand. And then the young princes and royalty were being educated in the monasteries, so they took it up, and it became hugely popular, all the rage on the royal circuit. And to this day, I think it remains a kind of perception, at least, of being kind of an elite sport.
But we get a kind of contrast of that and the origins of American football and soccer. Tell us a little bit about that and how, you know, the difference in these two sports reflect the cultures and the atmospheres that gave rise to them.
One of the things that I found fascinating was how the way games originated centuries back still affects the way they're played today. So as I said, tennis has this kind of elite, aristocratic origin. On the contrary, soccer, or really every game of football, began as this people's sport. In the same medieval period in England, games of football were played, only they were played by literally everyone in the village, one village against another, hundreds of people in these massive scrums that were played on special feast days. They were kind of festive communal rites, and they were raucous affairs. In fact, in the 14th century alone, English monarchs banned the game 9 times because they did so much destruction to property. And so it became, over time, it kind of remained this people's game. And it's no wonder that it's a global game that, you know, the last World Cup was watched by 3.2 billion people, half the planet.
It is the sweeping popularity of these games that's so interesting. In fact, you write in Mesoamerica, a game often called the world's very first ball game played by the Aztecs with very, very high stakes. This game of ulama, is that how you say it?
That's right.
Can you describe it to us?
Ulama was played as early as 1500 BC. It was played in an alleyway with sloping walls and these big hoops, kind of like basketball rings, only tilted sideways. And the players would strike the ball with their hip. And the most fascinating thing is that the ball itself was made of this substance that the rest of the world didn't know for millennium later, which is called rubber. So they invented rubber, and they put it to good use. The thing that is a little grisly and dark about the game is that in at least some of them, the loser was ritually sacrificed. It kind of adds a new meaning to the idea of sudden death.
Okay, so we look at the evolution from there to what we're looking at now in sports. I have a dear friend who always says, you know, the sports pages are the, he reads it first because it's the only place where there's resolution in the newspaper. Not so much anymore. You know, the stories are unresolved, battles over money and doping scandals and injuries and bribes. How has play and sports changed over the years? I mean, you're looking at a very long arc, obviously.
It's changed for sure. I mean, it's been incremental. I mean, you know, sports has always had gambling and there's been corruption in the past. But I think we've reached kind of new heights or new lows, as they might say. It's become obviously a huge business, a $500 billion global business, as you said. And that raises the stakes in general. And I think, you know, you see it with steroid use. You see it even with youth sports. And I think what's lost is something about the essence of the games themselves and why they matter and the very idea of play.
Is that what you think you discovered? Is that the object of the game that you went on this quest for?
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of like Nike says, just do it.
Well, John Fox, I really want to thank you for doing it because you did it all over the world, and it's a terrifically enthralling read. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Virginia.
John Fox, an anthropologist. He's written for the Smithsonian, Outside Magazine, and Salon, among others. He's also a regular contributor for our pals over at Vermont Public Radio and the author of The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. You'll find links to more on the book and to reviews at wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up, the psychological underpinnings of superheroes and their fans. That's when Word of Mouth continues. Just a moment.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
For Word of Mouth.
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 Well, Duff Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last weekend, the box office bowed to the newest Marvel comic turned blockbuster. The Avengers pits a group of superheroes against their greatest villain yet, their own superegos.
I thought I didn't qualify.
Apparently I'm, what is it, volatile, self-obsessed,
and don't play well with others.
We're not a team. We're a time bomb.
Robert Downey Jr. there as Iron Man Tony Stark and Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner, also known as the Hulk, both sounding like they're ready for an intervention. Robin Rosenberg is here to help. She's a superhero therapist whose analyses of comic book characters and Comic-Con superfans was profiled by Pacific Standard earlier this month. Robin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Have you seen The Avengers yet?
I must confess that I did see it during the weekend.
Well, it's a good thing because we'd love you to go through a sort of speedy diagnosis of some of the principal characters. Are you willing?
I don't know about diagnoses, but a thumbnail psychological
okay,
sketches.
Okay, profiles. Let's do that. First
okay,
off,
great.
Billionaire and genius Tony Stark, or Iron Man. Tell us about his psychological makeup.
Many people wonder whether he has a narcissistic personality disorder, but I think people who have that problem or that disorder are unrealistically full of themselves. And it's a question about whether he's realistically full of himself. He is, after all, a billionaire and incredibly brilliant inventor who creates, you know, new technologies left and right. And aside for that, you know, is Iron Man after all. So the fact that he's full of himself might be justified.
How about the God of Thunder, Thor?
That's a little confusing. having a god walking among men.
He's got to be a little full of himself, right?
Yes, absolutely. But
yeah, how can
I
you say he has a god complex if he's a god?
Exactly. We're on the same page there. I actually think he's, in a sense, the least interesting. I think it's hard to be an interesting god unless you're capricious, and he, fortunately for humans, is not.
All right. Well, we'll move on to someone more exciting. The scientist and I guess Marvel's equivalent of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Bruce Banner, who turns into the Hulk.
You know, the Hulk... basically, he really is someone with an alter ego, and the Hulk is traditionally like a 2-year-old with anger management issues. and Bruce Banner's a really smart, mellow guy. he's not necessarily an alpha male in the way that the Norse god and the inventor are, but understated, who really just tries to stay on an even keel and do the right thing. But sometimes his other self breaks through, which, you know, happens to all of us when we have some emotional dysregulation problems.
Maybe not in such a big way.
Right, and not so green.
And how about the super soldier Boy Scout, Captain America?
That's actually, I think, the most interesting psychologically, in a sense, because he wasn't buff, as we might say, before the serum. He was easy to overlook. He was small. He was puny in a time in the 1940s when that was really not very fashionable. So even though he's now really cool in his uniform and really strong, inside he's still that person that he was originally, just like someone who's heavy as a kid and loses weight as an adult still feels fat, or someone who grew up very poor and is rich still often feels poor. So I actually think that's kind of interesting piece of his makeup. Yeah.
Well, let's get on to another superhero. Here's a clip from Spider-Man 3. In this film, Peter Parker, he's in turmoil. Here he is in one of those good guy loses his moral compass scenes.
Everything okay here, Paul?
Take him out of here.
Let's go, sir.
Take your hand off of me.
Now.
Okay. Hey, stop!
Peter, stop it! Who are you?
I don't know.
Oh, Peter Parker doesn't know who he is. I can't help but think, Robin Rosenberg, of that kind of Jungian archetype of the hero. In my memory, it's the one we want to project to the world. It's your ego on a quest to individualize the self and battle against the shadows of its own self. Is that what drives the superhero?
That's one way of framing it. I guess I like to think that superheroes in general each have some ability. Sometimes it's an alien ability, sometimes it's a human ability. But they have a gift, and they want to try to make use of it. Say, okay, I can do this, so what? Now, how do I live a meaningful and fulfilling life? And I think that's true in our world as well, and that's part of why we resonate with superheroes.
Well, I think our 10-minute version of the 50-minute hour is over, and I want to thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia. It was great.
Robin Rosenberg, Palo Alto psychologist and author of the forthcoming The Psychology of Superheroes, and a regular columnist for Psychology Today. You can find links to her work and Spencer Ackerman's profile of Robin for the Pacific Standard at wordofmouthradio.org. Ever since George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, zombie flicks have played fast and loose with scientific terminology.
The chimps are infected. They're highly contagious. They've been given an inhibitor.
Infected with what?
Rage.
Danny Boyle's 2002 film 28 Days Later was among the first to insert gritty scientific realism to the frequently campy genre. Recently, popular books like Max Brooks' World War Z and Colson Whitehead's Zone One took serious literary stabs at the realm of the living dead. Actual scientists are following suit and devoting their attention to the fictional study of zombies as well. Bradley Wojtek is cognitive neuroscientist studying memory at the University of California, San Francisco, and he's one of the world's leading experts on zombie brains.
A really good neurologist can, by doing a couple of behavioral tests, deduce exactly what is wrong with the person's brain. And so we basically apply that same kind of principle, but treating the zombie as though it was a patient that had walked into an ER or something like that. And so from that, we're able to deduce a whole cluster of brain regions that would have to be damaged or, you know, differentially active in order to give rise to the classic zombie-like behaviors of, you know, the sort of shuffling walk, insatiable hunger, moaning,
brains.
Lack of fine motor skills.
Oops, dropped brain.
You know, all these kinds of classic zombie symptoms. We basically use this as a tool to teach what normally can be the very boring aspects of neuroscience. Using science fiction, which people find actually interesting, to teach science fact is an extremely good way of engaging public interest in science.
Of course, real-world biology can be just as bizarre, complex, and potentially inspirational as fictional zombie science. David Hughes is an assistant professor of entomology and biology and a member of the Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics at Penn State. He's been studying an organism in the forests of Thailand that has been mystifying biologists for years, the zombie ant fungus. Word of Mouth producer and zombie voiceover specialist Taylor Quimby spoke with him to find out more.
The zombie ant phenomenon is a really interesting one in nature. We have known about it for about 100 years, or we've known that fungi live on ants and other insects, but only in the last 5 or 6 years have we really delved into the phenomenon. And when we've done that, what we have discovered is a great degree of complexity and specialization. So ants which are out in the forest foraging encounter a fungal spore which attaches to their cuticle. This spore then grows through their cuticle into their body and replicates over a period of days. And at a certain time, the fungus produces compounds which changes the ant's behavior. So the ants leave the nest and they go and die in very special locations in the forest, attached to the underside of leaves. This happens at particular leaves, particular points on the leaf, particular time of day. So it's a highly specialized manipulation.
And then what happens?
Then the fungus grows an enormously large stalk out of the back of the ant's head, really the stuff of science fiction. And then spores are shot out from this spore body, which infect other ants, and the cycle continues.
Now, recently, you and your team have discovered a parasite that's attacking the zombie fungus that's attacking the ants. Have I got that right?
Yes, that's true. Earlier on, we found that these zombie ant fungi occur in high densities in the forest. That's not surprising because ants themselves occur at high densities in the forest. And the fungi feed upon these, creating large graveyards of dead ants, which are common and easy to find. Most of these zombie ant fungi are not actually a threat to the colony because they have been taken out by another player. This is a hyperparasitic fungus, a fungus which feeds upon the fungus that has killed the ant.
Do you think the level of specialization you see with the zombie ant fungus legitimizes the possibility of a virus, a plague, or something, you know, something resembling what we see in science fiction?
Well, we do have parasites that control human behavior. We have the very well-known and very famous toxoplasma, which
you get from cats, correct?
You get from cats. It's specialized to live in rats, and it causes rats to lose their fear of cats, and therefore is transmitted from the rat to the cat, but it's found in everything from blue whales to humans. And some really excellent work coming out of the Czech Republic has shown that your probability of having a car crash, you're 2.5 times more likely to be in a car crash if you're affected by this parasite because it upsets a lot of your key functions. So this parasite is the second biggest killer on the planet after malaria. So there's already known examples of human behavior being affected by parasites. But to your directed question, could we find something like this happening? I'm sort of agnostic on that.
That's about the most honest answer I could expect from that kind of question. What do you think about the current cultural fascination with zombies? Why are people so fascinated by the idea of their bodies being taken over?
Oh, this is really fascinating. It's incredibly interesting. I'm the scientific consultant on World War Z, which is the Brad Pitt Paramount movie. On the zombie apocalypse. I can't answer that. Some social theorists have suggested that it's because of a disenchantment people feel with modern societies. In the 1950s, when we discussed zombies, people thought that the reason for zombies was irradiation, so reflective of the Cold War zeitgeist at the time and the fears of an apocalypse due to a nuclear Armageddon. Nowadays, people think about it in terms of infectious diseases. The success of movies like Contagion really brings home the point that we are quite fearful, quite concerned with pandemics. So maybe that's the reason. Maybe we're fearful of that, or we live in some way a disenfranchised society. We don't really interact with people, even though we live in cities of millions of individuals. And so the idea of something taking us over resonates for some reason.
That was David Hughes, assistant professor of entomology and biology and a member of the Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics at Penn State. He was speaking there with Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby. There's more on David's research on the zombie ant fungus and on neuroscientist and zombie expert Bradley Wojtek at wordofmouthradio.org.
It's the time of the season when love runs high.
Stay with us for a walk back through time in today's North Korean capital, Pyongyang. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.
With pleasured hands to take you in the sun.
from New Hampshire Public Radio. This is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The well-publicized, albeit failed, launch of a satellite by North Korea last month sent a signal to the international community. Kim Jong-un is carrying on in the brinksman-like tradition of his father, Kim Jong-il. Il and his father built and maintained what is arguably the most isolated country on the planet, the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea, or DPNK. Most of us will never visit that country or see the grand monuments or stadia of its capital, Pyongyang. Philip Moise is an architect and general planner for several German embassies and also head of Dom Publishing and the editor of an absorbing and eerily beautiful two-volume architectural and cultural guide for the city of Pyongyang. He's on the line with us from Berlin. Philip, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good afternoon.
So what were the conditions for being offered these photographs? It's a notoriously closed society.
When I came to North Korea, I had a chance to discuss this possible guidebook with the North Korean publishing house. And the conditions they gave me is that I could use their materials, which is indeed propaganda photographs, without any additional context. So I was forced by contract to use only these images and this material within one guidebook.
And then you wrote a second guidebook that was a little more, let's say, taking liberties. In fact, you write in the introduction to Volume 2 that if anyone's using this to plan a trip, they're going to be disappointed. Why would that be?
I mean, the disappointment for going to North Korea is that you cannot go there and use this guidebook. Because if you go to North Korea, you are always guided by representatives of the government or of the partner you have in North Korea. You cannot walk alone through the city, through the streets, and everything is controlled. So if you go there, it's a little bit disappointing. As a Westerner, you are used to visit the city, to explore your own. You have your guidebook, and you can try to find special architecture and breathtaking buildings, but not so in North Korea.
Mm. It's so funny. It's a guidebook to a city that isn't a guidebook in some sort of way. But also the city almost looks to me like a diorama of a city, you know, something you'd see at a museum. In the photographs, the buildings are fantastic, but there's no signage, there are no cars, there are no trash, no people.
So that's very special in Pyongyang. If you go there, you find a, let's say, ideal socialist city, and it's the capital. You don't see any billboards. The only color you see in the street are some propaganda posters. You see big monuments of the leaders. You see empty streets, and wherever you go, you just think you are, let's say, an actor on a stage which is empty. It's everything looks like a big theater stage.
Pyongyang is a rebuilt city. After the war, there was a fresh opportunity in some ways. It was kind of leveled to unify architecture after being destroyed in the war. This makes it a kind of urban planner's utopia. How is it set up?
I mean, when Pyongyang was to be reconstructed after the Korean War, there was just nothing. And when they started to continue the reconstruction of Pyongyang, I mean, you have also to take into consideration it used to be and still a communist country, and in a communist country, there is no ownership of land. So when they started to reconstruct the whole city, they could just do it according to their theories, to their ideas, to the utopian plan of reconstructing socialist city. And in fact, until today, Pyongyang looks like a city which was drawn on paper and then implemented in real buildings.
Philip, we have just a minute left, so I'm just curious about what it felt like for you. I mean, it's such an isolated country, no internet, only state media. In fact, Google Earth gives us a limited glimpse, but there's no Google Street View. How did it feel for you being there, walking around?
The first hours, the first day you are there, it's very exciting. I mean, everything is new. You are always guided. It's like being in a government trip, and you go around wherever you go. People are waiting for you. But sooner or later, you find out everything is very artificial, and you obviously sooner or later you try to get some contact with the people in the street, but that's not possible. You go into a city like Pyongyang, and you always try to find out more what is behind all these beautiful facades, all these clean streets. But then you find out, you ask a question, but there is no one to give you an answer. And that's very disappointing in the end.
Well, I want to thank you, Philip. The books are just absolutely stunning, and I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Philip Moyza, an architect and head of Dawn Publishing, which has published several just gorgeous architectural construction and design manuals and guides to Taiwan, Tokyo, and now Pyongyang. You'll find a link to more on the guide, including some terrific images. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. NHBR's All Things Considered host, Brady Carlson, regularly joins us for Here's What's Awesome. That's his regular roundup of viral memes and trends. I'd also like to thank Brady for sitting in as a substitute host and frequent social media contributor and prolific finder of ideas for word of mouth. Recently, something crossed his radar that got his ears perked up, so of course, we encouraged him to run with it.
I have to admit, getting up close to new ideas like we do every day on Word of Mouth is really fun. Because the thrill of discovery never gets old, even if it does wear off over time. I'll give you an example, the laser. Today it's super commonplace, but 50 years ago, it was one of the coolest things in the world. And here's how I know this. James Bond, the ultra-suave spy who could quip his way through a battle to the death, he got a little freaked out when supervillain Auric Goldfinger fired his laser up for a little demonstration.
It can project a spot on the moon. Or at closer range, cut through solid metal.
I think you've made your point, Goldfinger. Thank you for the demonstration.
Now, most of us amazed by lasers weren't hoping to maim secret agents with them, but we did feel like the right laser pointed in the right direction could do pretty much anything. And truth be told, that's what they did. Lasers showed up in our CD players, then DVDs and Blu-rays. Laser pointers, progressive rock concerts, eye surgery, hair removal, bug zappers.
Here you can see the laser strike, parts of the mosquito breaking off, and the body falling to the ground.
And in a way, adding the laser to everyday stuff like mosquito control also zapped away the laser's wow factor. Cats may still geek out when they see the laser pointer come out and it's time for a chase, but for most humans, lasers are just too common now to be amazing. Note I said most humans.
You know, toasting the bagel, I think a laser would be faster.
That is Dr. Mark Bendett of Lockheed Martin Acolyte. And after his morning dreams of laser-heated breakfast, he spends his day developing laser-powered medical products, like this one.
You know, we're currently developing a new line of cochlear implant that is, in fact, based on the interaction of light with the nerves inside your ear.
If the idea of using light waves to help someone hear strikes you as peculiar, let's explain first how people actually process sound. Here's the simple version.
Normally, the way your hearing works is a sound will hit your eardrum, it'll vibrate the fluids inside the ear, that fluid will tickle little hair cells, and that produces a sound in your brain.
People with hearing loss don't have those tiny little hair cells because of disease, genetics, or damage. Cochlear implants replicate what the hair cells do using electrodes, which according to Bendett do a pretty good job reproducing sound, just not a perfect one.
It's like trying to play on a piano with only a limited number of keys. 4, 8, or 10 keys on a piano and trying to recreate Mozart, that would be a hard task to do. What we've developed is a technique of doing the same thing, except with far more precision using light. If we can give you all 88 keys back, you still may not be able to play Mozart, at least I know I couldn't, but many people could, and you could restore basically the full quality of sound.
Bendett says there's still plenty of performance and safety testing to do on the laser-based cochlear implants, but once those concerns are addressed, people with hearing impairments could hear the full scale of a Mozart piano concerto. They could check out a music and laser light spectacle courtesy of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, or maybe they could just take in a movie.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Brady Carlson is NHPR's All Things Considered host and our purveyor of all things awesome. For a link to more on those incredible laser implants, click on over to wordofmouthradio.org.
Gold finger, he's the man with the Midas touch.
We're grateful you could spend some time with us today. Please tune in next week for more of what's new, what's bubbling up, and what's been flying under the radar. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan, Dan the man, runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.